Well, at least get started on the story of Micha. Right? I'm not going to go through a whole review of everything we did with Shimshon at this point. You can go back and catch the audios and all that. But we need to see this remarkable story. It takes two prakim. It's Perek Yud Zayin, Perek Yud Ches, and this story is just bizarre. Right? And I say that, you know, it's a book of strange stories. But this one, I mean, it, in some ways, is even stranger than the one that follows, which is Pilegesh Begiva. And those who know that story know how terrible that one is. But look at the outline I gave you on your sheet in source number 13, please. We start out with the origin of an idol that will become known as the idol of someone named Micha. And we'll see that. It's going to be followed by Micha buying a Levi for himself to serve as a Kohen for his idols. The tribe of Dan is going to visit the area for reasons that we'll see. And they're going to do a reconnaissance of territory. Those who were here for Yehoshua will remember that Dan ends up with two different areas. One in the west-southwest, and then one in Laish, which is way up in the Bashan. Right, the bracha that Moshe gives to Dan is Yezanek min HaBashan, but his original land is not there. That happens in this story. Dan is going to go up to Laish, but along the way, they're going to find the idol of Micha. And they're going to take it over for themselves, and take the idol away from the temple that it's in order for them to worship with it. And then Dan is going to conquer Laish. It's just the most bizarre story, and I have only told you part of it, just the basic outline. When you get into the details, you look at it and think, really? That happened? Why didn't they teach me that in school?
I was going to say, I've never heard this
story. Yeah, no, I mean, it's true. In school, they don't really go into this story, because I think it's just too difficult to explain this to school children. How do you do that? Because kids usually, in the standard Yeshiva day school, kids are learning Yehoshua Shofu in grade 4, grade 5, and you're already, you know, if you do anything with Shimshon, you're already walking on eggshells trying to explain him. And then you get to this, and she's like, okay, let's move on to Shmuel.
They did so many bad things during this period. Like, why, what's the point of it? And also, why put it here if it didn't happen here either?
No, but
right.
Who is this Micha?
We have to talk about all of these questions. These are all good questions. So the first point is the point that Alina is alluding to, which is that this story, as well as Pilegesh Begiva coming next, don't occur at this point in the book. This is not chronological order, meaning we went through the Shoftim one by one, and commentators seem to assume that they appear in their chronological order. These two stories are transplants. They come from earlier within the book, and they're put here at the end. Now, that is in Medrash, called Seder Olam, which deals with chronology of Jewish history. Rashi, Ralbag, secular scholars, they all say that. The timing, they generally believe it appears. There are those who disagree, and you can probably tell me who's going to disagree, and you'll be right. Who's going to disagree? Yeah, thank you. That's his job. You know, someone's got to do it. We'll talk about his view. They're assumed by those who say they're displaced. They're assumed to go all the way back to the beginning of Shoftim. Our first Shofet was Othniel ben Kenaz. He was the one who fought off Kushan Rishathaim. And it was moved here to show how low we reached. Like, you get to the end of this book. Remember the arc of Tanakh in general, right? So Yeshua, you get into the land, we divide up the land. Shoftim is this period in which we descend into lawlessness, and then in Shmuel, we are given the kings to try to lead us in a proper direction. That's when we're supposed to come up. So it's at the end of Shoftim, before we're going to see Shmuel, that we get a description of just how bad things were prior to David.
It's a bit more illustrative of
yes.
Society.
Precisely. So that's the idea. Ralbag offers an interesting suggestion. If you take a look on the sheet at source number 15, 14 is Rashi. I forgot. I brought you Rashi there as well. Rashi says, "Afal pi shenichtav shnei parshiyos halalu b'sof ha-sefer," even though these are recorded at the end of the book, "shel micha v'shel pilegesh begiva b'tchilas ha-shoftim haya," they happened in the beginning. "B'mei Othniel ben Kenaz," in the days of Othniel ben Kenaz, and he brings you one of his reasons for saying so, which we're going to come back to. So I'm going to hold off on that piece of Rashi. But the Ralbag is what I want you to see, the one that's in 15. V'hine achshov shekvar hayazeh b'yamim hakidumim shelo hayasham shofet. I think this happened in the early days when there was no shofet. What do you mean there was no shofet? We had Yehoshua before the shoftim. So he explains. V'hayazeh b'yamim hashibud. It was during the period when we were subjugated to those around us. So we didn't have a shofet to lead us. Im kodem Asniel ben Kenaz, im kodem Ehud, im kodem Achamei Abayim Achareihem, before the rise of Asniel ben Kenaz or Ehud or whatever, meaning the view of Ralbag is that the shoftim are not contiguous. We talked about this in our introduction way, way back. The view of Abarbanel was that the shoftim were contiguous. You went from shofet to shofet to shofet, it's like having kings. One king is gone, there's a new king. Whereas Ralbag is of the view that there's a vacuum period. Where we're suffering, then we cry out, then Hashem sends us a shofet. The shofet is with us for a while, a shofet dies, vacuum period, we're in trouble, we cry out, new shofet. But there's a gap. And he says that's when this happens, and he's bolstered by the fact that as we're going to see, it's going to reiterate for us three times in the course of the next two chapters, next two stories, that this is a period when there's no Melech B'Yisrael, there's no leader. There's nobody to say, this is what you do, this is what you don't do. And that's part of the problem. So that's the way that Ralbag reads it. The question is, why do you believe that this story does not belong here, but in fact goes all the way back to the beginning? Can we take an extra 2 minutes or so? Because we had to start late, so I was at the Leviathan. Okay. So Rashi's approach, which I have for you in 14, but I'll say it outside, is that we're going to say that the idol of Micha was in Dan, for as long as the Mishkan was in Shiloh. Well, the Mishkan has been in Shiloh since the days of Yehoshua. So therefore, this story must be from earlier. He also has a comment about the Yebusi that I don't want to go into right now. Radak and Abarbanel are not convinced by Rashi's point, because they say all it means is, from now, the idol was there and done, as long as it remained in Shiloh, because after all, no one is claiming this story took place when Shiloh was established back in the beginning of Yehoshua's time. There was no idolatry in the days of Yehoshua. The Navi tells us that. So they're not so impressed by this argument. But there are other reasons. I brought you source number 16, where I list you factors. These are the factors. 1831 is the sentence that says that the idol was in Dan as long as the Mishkan was in Shiloh. But then, timeline. Ralbag is very big along the way on counting up the years listed for each shofet to make sure that it fits the length of time for everything. We even used it at one point when we were trying to figure out chronology a while back for one of the shoftim. So Ralbag says, if you count up the years, there aren't enough years left after Shimshon and before Eli for these stories to take place. It doesn't work. Abarbanel is not impressed. Abarbanel says, that doesn't convince me of anything. Okay. The Dan Mikra offers three different arguments for it. First of all, Dan is going to conquer Laish, right? The era of conquest was in the beginning of the Shoftim. At this stage, no one's conquering anything. It doesn't fit here. Further, we're going to see in Perek Yudchet, the end of Perek Yudchet, someone is going to show up in the story who's identified as Moshe's grandson. Now, he could be very long-lived, right? I mean, we talk about Pinchas being around still. But still, that's a lot for someone to be around as Moshe's grandson, unless this is happening in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, in which case it's normal. Right? You only have 28 years from Moshe's death until the period when the Shoftim start. And then his third argument is, because we're going to see Pinchas show up in Perek Yitet, when we get to the story of Pilegish Begiva, Pinchas is going to return. Now, we've talked about Pinchas being around in David's time. Depending on how you read Divrei Hayamim, he could be around even then. But if you don't take that read of Divrei Hayamim, then it's really odd to think, again, that Pinchas is still around at Pilegish Begiva at the end of the period of the Shoftim. That makes him, I don't know, 500 years old? That's a lot of years to be old. That's another one. And then the last argument, Kaufman's argument, is that if you look back at Shiras Devorah, when Devorah sings about the battle, and she talks about which Shvatim came to help and which Shvatim did not. So Yechezkel Kaufman reads that story, reads her song, geographically. Each Shevet that she lists, when she talks about this Shevet came, this Shevet did not, this Shevet did, this Shevet did not, she's working her way geographically. She's speaking about different areas. And Dan is mentioned between Gilad and Asher. Gilad is east of the Jordan, and Asher is up north, west of the Jordan. So it makes it sound like, he thinks, that means Dan is up there, which is the conquest of Laish. So therefore, they must have already conquered Laish back then. Parenthetically, that sets up a good, interesting question, because she says Dan stayed with his boats. So which boats are they? They're not on the Mediterranean anymore. So he comes up with an explanation for the boats also. He's good with that. But the bottom line is that most commentators, and again, Barbanel is going to be a holdout. We'll have to see that. But most commentators are of the belief that these stories occurred much earlier, and maybe next time we'll start with the question of why these stories are here together at the end if they occurred back then. I already gave you one concept of it in terms of showing how low they had sunk, but there's more that we have to...
Why are they in Shoftim altogether?
Well, they're in that book. This is when they happened. But you're asking why record them, period. So we'll see when we talk about why put them here. You get a sense.
Is it possible because of Dan, like a sequitur with,
Correct. That's one... Right. That's one suggestion that is made, is that it's because here's done and here's done. So we associate the two. Not only that, there's one idea which all the Mefarshim say somebody said and they don't like it, but they don't tell you who said this. In the beginning of this story, we're going to hear about 1,100 silver coins that a woman had. And they're going to say, well, Delilah was given 1,100 coins by each of the Sarnei Plishtim. Maybe this is Delilah even, and the stories are merged. And every commentator who talks about it says, there's somebody who says this, and he's just wrong. They all have the same attitude. Okay. We'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.